73 Russian rubles to the U.S. dollar today. We will tell you why we're telling you that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday today, 27 April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today not with stocks. They are fine, by the way. Yesterday's Tsuris notwithstanding. We begin today not with inflation, though we will get there in a minute, of course. No, we begin today with a little natural gas hardball. U.S. nat gas prices were up 5% today. The proximate cause being news out of Moscow that the Russian energy giant Gazprom has made good on its promise and has stopped sending natural gas to, and this is their quote, hostile nations, specifically Poland and Bulgaria, because they have both declined to pay Russia in its preferred currency, its own ruble, as opposed to the aforementioned U.S. dollar. Marketplace's Lily Jamali starts us off with the geoeconomics of global energy.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen called Russia's decision to stop delivering gas to parts of Europe blackmail. That's exactly what it is, says analyst Pavel Molchanov, who's with Raymond James, a Marketplace underwriter.
It is the use of energy as a means of political pressure. That is the definition of blackmail.
Molchanov says the tension between Russia and Europe has reached new heights.
It's the first time during this war that Russia is explicitly using energy as a weapon.
Russia has yet to use that weapon against Germany or Italy, two of its most valued customers. By contrast, Tom Marzik-Manzer, head of gas analytics at ICIS, calls Poland and Bulgaria easy targets.
Both of them were due to end their long-term contracts with Russia at the end of this year. So I'm not convinced other customers would receive the same treatment, but it's still a threat.
And yet some European buyers appear to be giving in to Russian President Vladimir Putin's demands, opening accounts at the country's Gazprom bank, according to Bloomberg. So they could pay Russia in rubles. But Princeton's Lukasz Rahel says the currency issue matters less than the fact that Europe is still hooked on Russian energy.
We're sending them a lot of resources in return for this energy that helped to finance the war machine.
Rahel says Russia's move came just hours after Germany sped up its timeline for finding alternatives to Russian oil, paving the way for an EU embargo, proof, Rahel adds, that Putin is under pressure. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Not under pressure today, Wall Street. Kind of a wash on the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Fed meets next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, and I'm just going to timestamp it right now. And look, this is no special insight that I have. Jay Powell has said as much out loud that the federal funds rate is going to go up a half a percentage point. But when you watch Powell's in-person press conference Wednesday after the meeting, because I know you will, I want you to listen for the phrase soft landing, how the Fed is going to get us out of all this inflation without getting us into a recession. Because it turns out the Fed's track record on being able to do that, well, it's complicated at best. Ben White wrote about it for Politico. Ben, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be here, Kai.
I'm going to say just flat out, the Federal Reserve has a terrible, terrible, terrible soft landing record.
It does. If it were a baseball player, it would be not even a AAA. I think they're, you know, 1-for-9 of the last 9, at least according to the analysts at Piper Sandler, who graded them and basically found one soft landing over the last 25 years or so, and that was in 1994. All the rest ended in recession or very close to recession.
Okay, let's define terms here, right? This is the Federal Reserve raising interest rates above that Goldilocks level of the neutral rate to try to slow things down, which the Fed is doing right now, and not causing a recession, right? That's the soft landing part of this.
Yeah, that's the Goldilocks, the goal. Every central banker's dream is to achieve the soft landing.
Okay, look, here comes the newbie question then. Why is this so hard?
Yeah, it's hard because it's a blunt tool, Kai. This is, you know, the main interest rate that influences all of the stuff that we borrow against, you know, homes, cars, anything you finance has, you know, a tie to current interest rates, which are tied to what the Fed does. And when it bumps them up, stuff is harder to buy. People buy less of it. Companies make less of it. Profits go down and then growth slows and sometimes reverses. And the economy gets a little bit smaller, which if it hangs on for a couple of quarters doing that, we call it a recession. But it's a big deal, the Fed having to raise interest rates, because, you know, we already, you know, we have this inflation. They want to fight it, get prices down. But when you raise interest rates, you by nature, by definition, what you're doing is slowing. You just want to finely tune it to the point where, you know, you slow enough that prices don't go crazy, but you don't shrink the economy. That's the trick to pull off, and it ain't easy.
Does it help at all, as Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed try to do this, does it help that the, as the politicians like to say, the economic fundamentals are reasonably strong?
Yeah, it does. And it sort of reminds me a little bit of 1994, the true soft landing period. And they are. You know, unemployment is low. Wages, as we've seen, have gone up. The economy pre-COVID was, you know, in decent shape, not blockbuster, but, you know, 2-3% growth. We don't have a dot-com crisis. We don't have a housing bubble. We had a global pandemic that, you know, messed stuff up terribly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the fundamentals are decent. So, you know, there's no reason to think they're going to tip us into a horrible, long, awful recession. It may be a short one that people notice, but doesn't crush them.
Here's the flip side of that, though, right? This is fundamentally a supply-side-driven inflationary period, right? We know about the ports being backed up. We know about booming demand coming out of consumers, right? And they just can't get the stuff into this country enough. The Fed can't do anything about that whole supply side thing. I mean, you raise rates, it slacks demand, but it doesn't do much for the supply side.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it is a concern that, you know, the Fed has no power there. I mean, that's partly, you know, policymaking power. Congress could do more to try to ease port delays along with the White House. But that kind of stuff, moving goods from A to B, is not within the Fed's purview, and interest rates won't do anything to impact that. So, yeah, we've got some structural issues that the Fed can't deal with here. All they want to do is stop prices from going up as much as they are, because it is too fast. And I'm sure you, like me and everyone else, goes to the gas station and the you know, grocery store and freaks out.
All right, so spitball this for me. Do you think they can do it, or even come close to a soft landing, given their terrible track record?
I think they can do it only because it is, you know, probably easier to get it out of this inflationary spiral without recession, given the underlying economy. So I think it's possible, but I think it's unlikely given the track record. I mean, you know, 1-for-9 doesn't suggest you're about to hit a home run. So I think unlikely. But if they do cause recession, it'll be short.
Ben White, Chief Economic Correspondent at Politico. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Pleasure to be with you.
This has been a challenging couple of years for teachers. Yes, because of the pandemic, of course. Also, though, because the teacher's salary just doesn't go as far as it used to. Now, nobody's does. That's true. Inflation. We have talked about that. But a report this week from the National Education Association, the big teachers union, points out that being an educator comes with all sorts of extra costs, as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
As an instructional assistant for math classes at Susquehannock High School in Glen Rock, Pennsylvania, Terry Hebel makes just under $15 an hour.
It's a little hard to stomach sometimes when basically what we have are students that are making more money at their job than we're getting.
Hebel says some high school students work at a local convenience store that pays $19 an hour. She's been full-time in her job for 6 years and uses her own money to stock the classroom with pretzels and Rice Krispie treats so that kids can focus on their geometry problems.
So that when kids are hungry, we are, you know, if they want water, here's a bottle of water. We're giving them water. We're giving them snacks.
The cost of those snacks has gone up significantly over the course of the past year. But Hebel's hourly wage hasn't caught up. It's set by a union contract that's negotiated every few years.
we have, as a profession, have still not kept pace with other professionals.
Becky Pringle is president of the National Education Association, a labor union with 3 million members, including Terry Hebble. Pringle says the fact that teachers' salaries are less than other Americans with comparable education and experience means they're often priced out of the communities where they work.
We're finding that to be more and more of the case where educators can't live where they teach because the housing costs are so high.
While the cost of living has risen, some teachers haven't felt the full effect of inflation combined with their own educational debt. They haven't had to pay their student loans, which are paused until August 31st. Marguerite Rosa directs the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown.
You could have a student loan payment that's $400 a month, and you don't have to pay it right now. So it may feel to many teachers like they might be flush with cash, but this is also temporary.
Rosa says a lot of the educators with loans are likely to be young teachers, who are also the most likely to quit. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Sometimes, all right, most of the time, you need more than 30 seconds to really flesh out a story, which is why we are going to go back to the big retirement news I ended the program with yesterday, that Fidelity, the biggest retirement plan provider out there and also a marketplace underwriter, is shaking up its 401k offerings. At companies that opt in, employees will be able to put as much as 20% of their retirement contributions into Bitcoin if they think that's a good idea. Whether it is or not is up to you, obviously. But the more important question right now for the retirement planning business is this. What do HR departments think of this? Marketplace's Matt Levin is on that one.
Fidelity says plenty of people are already pouring tons of money into crypto outside of their 401ks.
We have certainly seen the mainstreaming of digital assets and Bitcoin.
Dave Gray heads workforce retirement platforms for Fidelity. Obviously, companies in the crypto business might be interested in this type of thing, but Gray says he's already getting inquiries from outside crypto land.
We think that this solution certainly can be attractive to younger employees. Younger investors increasingly are comfortable with and immersed in the digital assets or just the digital economy.
But it won't be up to employees of any age. It'll be up to the companies. And there are good reasons they may decide not to offer the Bitcoin option, says Katie Hockenmeyer at Mercer, where she advises companies on 401k plans.
We don't think necessarily that super high volatility investments that many people don't necessarily have an extremely strong grasp on make a lot of sense.
Hockenmeyer says HR departments aren't just scared a 64-year-old employee might have to postpone their office retirement party because Bitcoin dips. They're scared that 64-year-old will sue them, which is why the Fidelity announcement was kind of a shock.
There have been a lot of questions from employers about, you know, why are they doing this? What is happening? I thought the Department of Labor said we really shouldn't be doing this.
The Department of Labor issued guidance last month telling companies they should exercise, quote, extreme care before adopting a retirement plan with crypto. Federal law holds companies liable for irresponsible retirement plans. And while HR departments might get emails from crypto enthusiasts asking where their 401k Bitcoin is, the cryptocurrency's carbon footprint could invite pushback from other employees. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we'll be out there trying to push our products.
Doing the best that they can. First, though, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 61 points today, about 0.2%, closed at 33,301. The NASDAQ basically flat, 12,488. S&P 500 up 0.2%, 41.83. So, how have businesses been feeling about this economy? If how much they spend for online advertising is any indicator, not so good. A decline in ad revenue is one of the lowlights of Alphabet's quarterly report. Google's parent missed revenue estimates, too. Shares fell almost 3.7% today.
flip side then, how have consumers been feeling about the economy? If how much they are charging to their Visa cards is any indicator, they're feeling pretty flush, thanks. Total payment volume for the quarter up 17%. That is according to the credit card company itself. Shares in Visa at about 6.5%. Bond prices went down. When that happens, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note and all bonds in point of fact goes up 2.83% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tech is this week, and yes, this happens a lot, I guess, but this week in particular with the Twitter news, tech is getting a lot of press, a lot of big splashy headlines. But out of the news, where the work actually gets done, there are a couple of trends in tech that have intensified over the past couple of years. Number one, there are more jobs than there are people to fill them. And number two, there's a realization that there's a need to diversify the tech workforce. And there is something happening that might address both of those issues. Companies are rolling back college degree requirements. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
A couple years ago, Stanley Amatayili was pursuing a degree in laboratory science in Nigeria when he got the chance to join his dad in Seattle. In the space of a month, he packed up his life and left his coursework behind.
Moving to the States, I'm thinking, oh, do I have to go through all of that again? Like, it felt impossible at first.
He knew he wanted to break into Seattle's tech industry, but he didn't have the time or money to go back to university. So he signed up for a coding boot camp, which led to an internship at Microsoft, which led to an apprenticeship at Box, a cloud storage company. Since January, he's been honing his software development skills while getting paid.
That opportunity to both learn and be able to apply all of that at the same time is just, you know, even coming here, I did not imagine that this is an opportunity that I'll be able to have.
Workers without college degrees bring all kinds of skills and potential and are key to a more inclusive tech industry, says Papia DeBroy, who leads research at the nonprofit Opportunity at Work.
When an employer requires a bachelor's degree, they're screening out almost 70% of our Black workforce, almost 80% of our Hispanic workforce, and they also screen out almost 75% of our rural workforce.
But while many tech companies say they're loosening up on degree requirements, it's easier said than done. A Harvard Business School analysis of IT job postings from 2017 to 2021 found many of the biggest tech firms still demanded degrees for upwards of 70% of jobs. Harvard's Joseph Fuller says it's likely because employers are looking for soft skills that are harder to prove on a resume.
Employers used college degrees as a proxy for social skills.
But there are a handful of companies that have made progress. One is IBM, where fewer than a third of IT jobs required a degree, the best rate among all the tech companies. Obed Louisant, IBM's senior VP for transformation and culture, says it can be more labor intensive to hire this way.
It does cause us to job by job and say, what's the success criteria, right?
Rather than relying on a degree as a catch-all, they have to figure out what are the actual skills that each position requires and how many of them can be taught.
What's more important than the technical skill? The curiosity to learn, right? Because we can teach someone who is curious and tech savvy a number of different skills.
The approach requires education for hiring managers, too, he says. At IBM, they go through training called License to Hire to ensure their practices are aligned with the company's goals and that they're not bringing their own college biases to interviews. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Big banks reported quarterly earnings a couple of weeks ago. They were fine. I mean, billions of dollars in profit were made January through March, just fewer billions of dollars than they had been making. One notable line item, many of those banks reported they are lending more money to businesses now than they did during the first 2 years of the pandemic. Back then, a lot of small businesses were relatively flush, thanks to all those big government relief packages. But even though commercial lending is starting to pick back up, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, some small businesses, well, they're thinking twice about taking on more debt.
If you're a bank, you've got a lot of incentives to lend money right now. For one, you've probably got a lot of money to lend from consumers who've been stockpiling savings and businesses that have been paying back their Paycheck Protection Program loans.
That's wonderful, but it is sitting around and banks need to put that money to work.
That's Chris Duncan, senior loan officer with LaSalle State Bank in Illinois. Another incentive, rising interest rates. They're finally making loans more profitable.
We would like to take advantage of the bump in interest rates to make some loans that have a little bit healthier of a margin for the bank.
So Duncan says the bank's planning to get a little more aggressive marketing its loans.
We'll be out there trying to push our products to folks who need them, folks we think that it'll benefit, and hopefully we'll have some luck in terms of loan volume increasing.
But so far, he hasn't had much luck. That's because many businesses don't see a need to borrow money. Randy George is co-owner of Red Hen Baking Company in Vermont. He says he has some cash left over from government relief programs.
Most of that's gone, but we felt that it was prudent to hold on to a little cushion, basically.
George says instead of making big plans that would require him to borrow money, he's been using the cash he has to make small improvements. For instance, he just bought a waffle cone maker and something called a tilt skillet that lets him cook larger batches of soup.
That's thousands, not hundreds of thousands. So that's actually a powerful, very worthwhile investment.
Mostly, he's trying to make his business more efficient. His bakery and cafe are still facing supply chain problems, higher costs, and a shortage of workers.
Right now, you know, we haven't even gotten back to our pre-COVID business hours, and that has a lot to do with staffing, you know. So we need to grow back into using the facility we have to its full potential.
While some business owners don't need to borrow, others don't want to.
I wouldn't even consider it.
James Beck is the owner of a hot sauce shop in Houston called Iburn. He says he'd think about taking out a loan if he wanted to expand the business, maybe open up a new location. But right now, forget it.
Why would I want to go into any type of expansion, regardless of what it is, just to have who knows what type of distraction or health crisis or international crisis?
Beck's been focused on making sure his business survives. This month, he moved the shop to a much smaller location in Houston. He's also keeping less product on hand.
You know, normally we would carry more substantial inventories that would allow us to then wholesale as well. But even the businesses that used to buy from us wholesale have stopped.
Beck says he hopes that downsizing will help him lower costs enough to make the business profitable again. He's also focusing on expanding online sales before thinking about taking on any debt.
When we can get to a point where we can kind of be able to see that, okay, next month or next year is going to be either consistent or back into increasing revenue, then, you know, I would reconsider.
But at this point, he says, not a chance. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Just final note on the way out today, a rare update on the Elon Musk Twitter deal. And I say rare because we are mostly in the weedy process phase of this transaction, and we are going to be, well, measured in our coverage. Anyway, the merger agreement is now public, and I direct your attention to Section 6.8, Public Announcements is the heading. And it says in relevant part, and this is a quote, the equity investor, that's Musk, shall be permitted to issue tweets about the merger or transactions contemplated hereby so long as such tweets do not disparage the company or any of its representatives. If you know anything about Elon Musk and Twitter, you know to take the under on that one. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. Of interest, perhaps, to the job seekers among you. The Journal does an average annual ranking of the hottest job markets in the country. Austin, Texas was number one in large metro areas. Makes sense. Major university, tech hub, lots of music, right? Number one in regional markets, Elkhart, Indiana, the RV capital of these United States. Now you know. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.